cause number 0518-00752-CV, J. Kyle Bass et al. Versus United Development Funding LP et al. Looks like we've got plenty of lawyers here. Everybody ready to go? We've got two counsel at each table. Are y'all splitting arguments or? Okay. All right. Other preliminaries. Anybody here got a phone or anything else that might go off during the argument? Please make sure it's turned off now. We have read the briefs, the important cases, the important parts of the record. We're familiar with the case. Not as familiar as you all are, but we're familiar with the case. I know we've got veterans here and you're familiar with the timing system, but I'll go over it anyway. Each side gets to open with 20 minutes and a three-minute warning. Appellant, you'll get a five-minute rebuttal with a one-minute warning. The yellow light comes on when your warning light comes on. That's your warning light. When the red light comes on, please finish your thought and wrap it up. Of course, if we're in the middle of dialogue with any member of the panel, we'll continue that. Because these are being recorded and most likely will be up on the website shortly, make sure that you state your name each time you come to the podium. It'll just make it clear whoever might be listening. And it looks like this case has developed some interest out there. With that, let's get started.
Thank you, Your Honor. Landis Best, representing the appellants, Kyle Bass and Hayman Capital. May it please the court, this case involves fundamental speech rights. Hayman blew the whistle on UDF. After years of research, Hayman made its concerns public about matters of serious public concern about the veracity of UDF's public financial statements, about potential financial misconduct at UDF. UDF was in the middle of trying to raise $1 billion from the public. Hayman's speech served as a warning to investors that UDF was a bad investment, that things were not as they seemed at UDF, that UDF was hiding the ball. And in fact, the SEC had been investigating UDF since 2014. And the SEC charged UDF with violations of the securities laws. UDF and its executives settled those charges and paid $8 million in fines, penalties, and disgorgement of ill-gotten gains. Hayman's speech is just the sort of speech that is protected by the TCPA, the Texas Anti-SLAPP Statute. It is designed to encourage speech that's a matter of public importance, and there can be no question that Hayman's speech was of public importance. And Hayman's speech led to good things. It led to more disclosure from UDF. They disclosed for the first time that they had been under investigation since 2014. The SEC complaint shows that the conduct of the funds transfer scheme stopped in December of 2015. Their fraudulent conduct stopped in December of 2015 when Hayman made its first posts. And, in fact, investors were able to take action to protect themselves, Your Honor. They were able to file complaints and try to recover damages. And it led to settlements. Money was recovered. And there were corporate governance improvements at UDF. These early warnings from Hayman saved investors from additional harm. There's no question that TCPA applies here. Counsel doesn't dispute it. Under the TCPA...
Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. You may or may not be familiar with it, but last December we decided a case, Breakaway Practice LLC versus Lothar, where we said that under Section 27006, pleadings are to be considered as evidence regardless of whether they're offered as such.
I'm sorry, the pleadings are what?
Regarded as evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whether they're offered or not. Do we need to go beyond reading the petition to determine whether the step two in the analysis has been met?
I think so, Your Honor. I think that you need to look not just at the evidence that's been presented. We don't dispute they've got the evidence, but you can look at and you can determine whether their characterizations are accurate.
Characterizations are reasonable inferences.
Right. Well, But if they make characterizations that are not true, that's something that the court can consider. And we're asking the court to look at events that happened in the world. Okay, so you have the pleadings, you have the evidence, but there's also, the court can take judicial notice of events that are happening in the real world. That's just basic. This court doesn't have to check its common sense at the door, Your Honor.
It was my understanding that the essential argument that you're making in your preliminary remarks seemed to go to the first phase of the TCPA analysis, which is not an issue here.
Right.
Central to your argument is that the plaintiffs failed to make a prima facie case.
That's right.
That your client acted with actual malice.
That's right.
Isn't that the heart of your argument?
That is the heart of our argument, Your Honor. That is clearly true. We think they have not made a prima facie case of actual malice. And the actual malice standard does apply here. And I'm happy to address that now, Your Honors. It's clear that the actual malice standard applies. And at a minimum, UDF is a limited purpose public figure. That is so with respect to the serious allegations of fraud and wrongdoing at UDF. We cited many factors that lead to that conclusion. UDF is a public company. That allowed them to have a bigger platform. That allowed them to register with the SEC to try to attract more investors. They were required to file public statements, quarterly statements, annual reports, invited public scrutiny. So it's clear to us that, when you look at the case law, that this is a purposeful availment. They have sought attention for themselves.
So you're saying every public company is by definition a limited public figure?
We have argued that, but that's not all we've argued, Your Honor. We think at a minimum they're a limited purpose public figure.
Is that the consequence that you're asking us to adopt?
We're not, Your Honor. The court does not have to rule that broadly at all. There are plus factors here. It's not just that they're a public company and they're SEC registered and they have to file public statements. They're also in the middle of trying to raise $1 billion from the public. Their CEO, Hollis Greenlaw, appeared on TV and radio, promoting his expertise and promoting UDF. They had active websites promoting the company, promoting their financial performance. These plus factors, I think, make it clear that they are a limited purpose public figure, and it's not just because they're just a public company. And remember, Heyman's comments called into question the validity of those public documents that UDF has invited the public to rely upon to invest. The UDF refers on what they call the anti-bootstrapping principle, and we think that's a complete misreading of the law, Your Honor. That's too narrow of a reading. They are saying that Heyman created the controversy, but far from the case. They were hiding the ball. The public controversy is the veracity of their public statements or financial statements when they're in the middle of trying to get $1 billion.
How does that go to the clear and specific evidence standard?
It
sounds to me like we're back in the application of the act standard.
You're right, Ron. It's the application of the actual malice standard. I'm just making it clear.
Let me assume for a minute that they are a limited purpose public figure.
Yep.
How is their evidence insufficient? I mean, help me out there.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor.
On the actual malice aspect.
Yeah. They have submitted evidence that they say is prima facie evidence of actual malice, but it's not the case. They rely primarily on profit motive. The case law is clear that profit motive is not enough. It's not actual malice, not evidence of actual malice. It's clear in the case law. A lot of people, we have a profit motive. UDF has a profit motive. Right? Excuse me. You were going to say?
No. Standing on its own, perhaps not.
Right. And that's all they have, Your Honor. Because the other things that they point to are simply not evidence, prima facie evidence.
Bad blood between the parties?
Bad blood.
That preceded this matter?
That, again, that's ill will and spite. They're alleging ill will and spite. Ill will and spite is not evidence of actual malice. The law is also clear that that is not evidence of actual malice.
What is?
Actual malice has to be knowing falsity, that my client knew what they were saying was false or was reckless acted with reckless disregard to falsity. Nothing that they have alleged shows that. They've tried to concoct.
But didn't they allege failure to properly investigate?
They did allege that, Your Honor, but if you look at their evidence, that's not... They've misrepresented that. That's not... If you look at the affidavits that my clients put in, all the research that was done, the dozens of posts, the hundreds of pages, clear they did research.
But that sounds like you're trying the case, not whether they've made a prima facie case in their pleadings.
Well, but they... Your Honor, they also... They claim we didn't do an investigation. Their main argument there is we didn't go to UDF to ask them their opinion. It's not credible. The case law says it's not credible. You can't expect that if someone's going to deny the allegations, and we had every reason to believe they were going to deny the allegations, they'd put out their 8K. We incorporated the 8K response, which was their response to our initial posts, into our posts. We responded to their arguments. The case law is clear. You don't have to go and speak to the person you're criticizing. If you have reason to believe they're going to deny it, it's clear what they were going to say. They said what they were going to say. They claim there was cherry picking. They claim that the research in our posts only was cherry picked to only show a certain, an unrepresentative number of loans. Your Honor, look at our posts. You don't have to just accept that if you look at the post, and that's not an accurate characterization whatsoever. We were very clear that we demonstrated a material number, a substantial number of loans that were not getting cash returns. We were transparent in that. We cited to their annual reports, their 10-Ks and their 10-Qs. We weren't trying to hide the ball. They're trying to hide the ball. We aren't cherry-picking. They're cherry-picking. So profit motive, a short seller obviously believes that a share price or a company is overvalued. That's what they believe. And they believe it, and they have skin in the game. They believe that. They publish the information because they want the truth to get out, not to try to harm UDF. They want the truth to come out. They want the information out there so that the marketplace can absorb what is happening. UDF was hiding the ball. And the SEC complaint, we think, just corroborates that there could be no prima facie case of actual malice. And I want to turn to that for a minute, because the SEC complaint, even without it, there's no prima facie case of the elements of their claim. But with it, it makes it all the more clear, Your Honor, all the more clear that this is a frivolous case. This is frivolous. The SEC came in and charged UDF with securities fraud. UDF is trying to hide the ball. They don't want you to look at the SEC complaint. They're trying to get you not to look at what's obvious, what's right in front of your nose. It's in the record. You can take judicial notice of it. We're not offering it to show the truth of the underlying allegations. We're offering it to show that the SEC made these allegations. They made the allegations. They don't dispute. They made those allegations. This is a case about harm from words said. And the SEC said virtually the same thing. There's no question that the core allegations of Hayman's posts and the SEC's complaint are substantially similar. The SEC complaint talks about a funds transfer scheme. The SEC complaint talks about financial irregularities, impaired assets, gap violations. The SEC complaint talks about land going undeveloped for years, growing loan balances. The SEC complaint talks about UDF misleading investors. These are substantially similar to what Hayman said. Substantially similar. We provided to you in our reply brief a comparison chart. It's at pages 6 and 7 of our reply brief. And it compares the core allegations of the SEC complaint and Hayman's post. And you'll see that they are substantially similar. Just looking at, for example, even the very first item that we cited to here, funds from UDF-4 were being routed to a borrower and being provided to UDF-3 to provide distributions. It's a funds transfer scheme. And we cited in our posts the SEC's definition of a Ponzi scheme, Your Honor. It's an investment fraud that involves the payment of purported returns to existing investors from funds contributed by new investors. The SEC might have used different words, but the concept's the same.
Ms. Best, how do you address their argument that Heyman was guiding the SEC to lead to the complaint to the SEC?
Your Honor, it's undisputed that the SEC started its investigation in 2014 before our client said a single word. And UDF disclosed the SEC investigation because of our initial post. They came clean. They said, by the way, we're under investigation by the SEC. Before we even said a thing. We weren't guiding the SEC. We went to the SEC, yes, because we were concerned. We don't dispute that. We were concerned that serious wrongdoing was afoot. We were concerned. We went to the SEC with our concerns. And then we also went to the public with our concerns. You know, the SEC complaint, they try to soft pedal it. They say, oh, it's just about disclosure failures. Your Honors, that's not persuasive. The SEC alleged securities fraud against them. They charged them with violation of Section 17A of the Securities Act, which is the use of interstate commerce for the purpose of fraud or deceit. In paragraph 38 and 39 of the SEC complaint, they talk about a doctored cash flow statement that UDF prepared and gave to their accountant, Whitley Penn. Your Honor, it's clear that the gist of the allegations in the SEC complaint is similar, substantially similar, to what Heyman alleged. And if anything, the sting is only worse from the SEC complaint because this is coming from the Securities and Exchange Commission. It's not a short seller. It's the SEC after they've embarked upon a lengthy investigation and they came to this conclusion. The market would only take these allegations more seriously than what Heyman had in its research that it published. Your Honor, I want to talk a little bit about falsity. We also believe not only that they have not set forth a prima facie case of actual malice, but also that they haven't set forth a prima facie case of falsity. And this starts from their gist that they set forth. And we think if you look at all of our posts in context, that the gist that they posit is not a reasonable gist. It's not reasonable that you can take these hundreds of pages and boil it down to this one sentence. Our gist, if you have to boil it down to a gist, is their financial statements are inaccurate. They're misleading. They're trying to hide the ball. We gave examples of that. Okay, but our gist is not a gentle gist. They claim our gist that we posit is a gentle gist. It's not. The gist that we posit is a hard-hitting gist. We agree. Our gist is critical. We were highly critical of UDF. But our gist is the genuine gist. And we do urge the court to look at Heyman's postings in context. UDF tries to set up straw men to try to knock down, to try to show that there's falsity. They come up with, there's no cash returns. They focus a lot about how we said there's no cash returns. We didn't say there were no cash returns. You can look at our postings. We never said that. We said there were not enough cash returns to satisfy investor distributions. And again, the SEC complaint, substantially similar. And UDF doesn't challenge the SEC complaint. I want to speak just briefly about causation.
Why is the SEC complaint the linchpin here? Does that somehow absolve your client?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Does it somehow absolve your client? Tell me why the SEC, why those allegations are so important to your case.
They're important because it shows, if we think it ripples through the lack of their prima facie case on falsity, on actual malice, and on causation. Again, this is a case about words said that cause damage. Here, on causation, Heyman's posts, UDF, it's their burden to show that Heyman's posts were a substantial factor of the alleged damages. And I heard Your Honor's discussing the Bustamante case on the first argument today. Under Bustamante, they have to show that our words were a substantial factor, that without it, the harm wouldn't have occurred. Your Honors, you could take away Haman's post. We'd be in the same sorry mess we're in right now. The SEC was investigating UDF since 2014. Their auditor declined to stand for reappointment. Their UDF board members resigned. Their broker had its broker-dealer license revoked. The FBI executed a search warrant on UDF's premises. They're under criminal investigation, Your Honor. They have a Wells notice. The SEC issued a Wells notice, which is an indication that they're likely to bring charges. UDF-4 was delisted by the NASDAQ. For failure, UDF failed to file their financial statements. The SEC complaint came in for securities fraud. And again, that relates to the 2014 investigation that had already started. I see my time is up, Your Honor. I can keep going, but it's quite clear that all these negative events
existed. I might have changed you a minute or two, so you can keep going a little bit.
Well, it's just not credible, Your Honor, to think that we wouldn't be in the same place we are right now, that UDF wouldn't suffer from these harms, because all these events happened. Whether Haman said a word or not, we'd end up in the same position. In fact, it's good that Haman spoke when it did. It warned investors. If they hadn't spoke when they did, more investors would have invested money, and more losses would have happened. Again, the SEC complaint is even worse for them. It shows the government's imprimatur.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Back to you.
Ready?
Ready, this time.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it may please the Court, my name is Ellen Sarango, and I'm here on behalf of the UDF plaintiffs and appellees. They are a group of local lenders to prominent Texas residential real estate developers. UDF's business took off during and after the Great Recession when bank financing dried up, and UDF became an alternative for developers who wanted to continue building in one of the strongest economies in the United States. UDF's business has supported construction of thousands of homes and developments in Texas, such as the residences at Stone Lake, Frisco Ranch, Frisco Hills, Highlands at Trophy Club, Sendera Ranch, and many others. We're here today before you because in December 2015, Haman began publishing a series of hit pieces attacking this legitimate business. And I want to talk about GIST. The gist of these posts were that UDF was a criminal Ponzi scheme, not a legitimate business. And at the trial court, in front of Judge Montgomery, we all agreed on this gist. Haman and us. Haman put the SEC definition of a criminal Ponzi scheme into evidence and told Judge Montgomery that UDF fit that definition. And Haman even made a Ponzi Madoff slide for the court, which is in Bench Exhibit 1 that I understand you have copies of. Haman made this slide, presented it at the TCPA hearing, moved it into evidence, and it has Ponzi, Madoff, and UDF. And the media easily and quickly picked up on Haman's storyline. We've put in all those headlines with reactions consistent to the Ponzi scheme gist. Today, Haman criticizes these media headlines as non-representative. But if you look at tab 2 of our bench evidence, Haman itself paid a public relations firm from New York to what it calls secure the exact same headlines about its story that it is now telling you aren't representative. So how can Haman say that's not its gist? And Haman's post got the point across. You've heard a lot about causation, but if you look at tab 3, The very same day, within hours of the post, UDF stock, which for a year and a half had traded in a narrow range, as soon as the post got distributed like wildfire, which is what happens in a short and short scheme, the stock plummeted. And we also put in the affidavits of our business partners, our banker, developer, brokers, who understood Heyman's Ponzi gist and just how severely that was going to harm the company, which caused them to immediately stop doing business with UDF. And those affidavits say they stopped because of Heyman's post, not because of all the other background facts that Heyman's relying upon for causation. So I believe, I'm sorry.
So on December 10th, the Heyman post is published, but my understanding is that shortly after that, UDF announces that the SEC had been conducting a fact-finding investigation since 2014.
UDF made that announcement after the close of the market on December 10th, and if you look at the chart, the stock dropped 35% before that announcement was ever made. So, Your Honors, I believe we've made the showing that a reasonable person, someone of ordinary intelligence, would understand the main thrust of Heyman's post was to attack UDF as an illegitimate business. And this argument that saying Ponzi-like somehow changed the gist, it doesn't, because look at all the other word choices Heyman made. Ponzi, Madoff, Stanford, investment fraud, exceeds $1 billion. So just adding like doesn't take away the sting. It sure didn't change the reader perceptions and the investor reactions. Heyman also now argues, completely contrary to its position at the trial court and in conflict with its PR campaign that we just looked at, that the main gist is simply that UDF is transferring funds from new entities to old in order to fund new distributions and concealing that fact. But that latecomer description is far too narrow to encompass Heyman's actual storyline. Heyman ignores that it chose to tell a story that tracked the definition of a criminal Ponzi scheme, an investment fraud with little or no legitimate earnings that required a constant influx of new money from investors to continue. Otherwise, it will collapse. The whole house of cards will come falling down. And why did Heyman invent? Why is he telling you something different than he told Judge Montgomery or that he told his PR company? Because Heyman is trying to contort its gist to conform to the allegations in an SEC complaint that came out 2.5 years after the post. And there's 5 problems with that argument. I thought there were 4, but there's actually 5. First, Heyman didn't even ask to put this in the record. At the trial court, Heyman never filed a motion to reopen the record after the court's decision when the SEC complaint came out. Never did that. Even if Heyman had done so, it would be improper rebuttal material under the TCPA. We are not here to litigate what Heyman thinks the SEC complaint means. Point number 3, Heyman admits, the SEC complaint is completely inadmissible. It has 0 evidentiary value. It's a settlement without any admissions. These types of settlements are so inadmissible that they've even been stricken from complaints that reference them by the federal courts. So why does Heyman spend so much time talking about it instead of addressing our prima facie case? And finally, if we're going to go to the substance, we're not running from it. We're not afraid of it. The SEC complaint actually repudiates Heyman's Ponzi illegitimate story. Despite their misrepresentations about what it says, after a thorough 4-year investigation, the SEC said UDF had to make some better disclosures, period. They did not take issue with one single business practice of this legitimate company. In sharp contrast to Heyman's allegations that UDF was an investment fraud, a Ponzi scheme, and not a legitimate business, the SEC does not challenge the legitimacy of UDF's business at all. UDF's business before and after the SEC settlement is exactly the same. The SEC did not require any changes to the business practice. The SEC did nothing to remove management. The SEC said that UDF negligently, without any bad intent, failed to adequately disclose certain things. Now, the company believes they did adequately disclose those items, and that's why there's no admission in the settlement. But in any event, the SEC did not say a single word about UDF's business being illegitimate in any way. It doesn't mention straw borrowers or misappropriated funds or worthless shares or Ponzi scheme. None of that's in there, and I made a list.
Does your evidence retract or withdraw any of the allegations in the petition? In other words, is your evidence simply an elaboration of or an illustration of the allegations in the petition?
Absolutely. Is there a specific allegation?
No, I'm there's a lot of evidence out there.
Yeah,
in a very
I understand.
Long petition. And so I'm trying to figure out really whether we need to look at anything other than the petition.
No, Your Honor, we had the petition, and then, of course, we had Dale Kitchens, a forensic expert who gave a very detailed affidavit that I think really highlights the malice here, just how hard Heyman had to work to come up with the false statements that it did.
So is there more in the evidence that deals with the reckless disregard aspect of actual malice or knowing falsity?
Yes, I believe Dale Kitchens' affidavit is important to read on that point because he explains in detail. Remember, Heyman said they swore, they extensively researched, studied these financials, and he explains how, given that, they obviously were lying. Mr. Greenlaw, the CEO, he has a section called malice within his affidavit that's separately stated out, which also goes through some things like, for example, the poster child of showing that this money was being misappropriated was a piece of land called Cheyenne Prairie that Centurion was developing. And Heyman contrasted Centurion's development with what it called a real development and said, well, look, this real developer, Taylor Duncan, they bought the land in 2012 and they had finished lots by 2014. And look at these Centurion guys. They bought the land in 2004 and it's just a dust bowl. And we walked through how all the lies underlying that and how Heyman would have known that. For example, that Taylor Duncan bought the property at the exact same time as Centurion, had a joint development agreement, and Centurion did develop the property. That's all laid out in Mr. Greenlaw's affidavit.
So you agree the actual malice standard applies in this case? You're a limited purpose public figure.
We don't agree with that. There's so much evidence of actual malice, and I can address them more, that it's not a determinative factor here. On the limited, we're obviously not a general public figure. On the limited public figure, what I would say is what this court, the most succinct thing I've ever heard on limited public figure, this court said in its Tatum opinion that, in short, first there must be a controversy before there can be a public one. And Heyman's arguments ignore that. There was no controversy. He points to, oh, you're a public company and you're filing 10-Ks and you're, you know, talking about them. But there was no controversy about us being an illegitimate business. He's failed.
You didn't get reversed on that point.
You did not. So we absolutely don't agree. But, I mean, I've never seen such overwhelming malice evidence at this stage of limited discovery, so we don't, you know, it's up to you what to do with that, but no, we don't
agree.
One
of the things I think Justice Whitehill alluded to and was alluding to was that we have precedent in this court that pleadings are to be treated as evidence in the TCPA analysis. And my question would be similar to his. Do we have to wade through all this evidence to reach a conclusion that's in your favor?
Well, let me put it this way. If you were at all inclined not to find falsity or malice, please read Dale Kitchen's affidavit.
Very well.
And read Mr. Moyetti's, this guy from Centurion. Haman accused this guy of being a complicit in a Ponzi scheme, said he was an illegitimate developer who was insolvent. And none of that was true. Mr. Moyetti testified. He put that under oath. And you don't see Haman even defend that comment, those statements, anywhere in its briefs. Just look. It's not there. So it just depends how far you feel you need to go. But, you know, there's a lot in there because we wanted to have – there's a lot of evidence here of that wrongdoing. We wanted to have it all in front of you.
Just to make sure everyone's on the same page, does Appley concede that the lawsuit is in response to Haman's exercise of the right of free speech?
We do not deny that the TCPA applies here. Correct. We do deny that we do argue that he abused those free speech rights, and as the Texas Supreme Court noted in Neely, even though there are free speech rights twice in the Texas Constitution, there's a right for a remedy for abuse of those rights. And that's exactly what we have here, abuse of those rights. But no, we don't disagree that the statute applies. It seems in Texas it kind of applies to almost everything. So, all right. The fifth point on the SEC, just to finish, is the Neely case, which Haman, we cited it extensively in the trial court in here, and Haman never addresses. And that case says even if the SEC had been a trial and these were findings of fact and they said bad things about the company, none of which happened here, Neely says you can still have a cause of action even where a plaintiff's been found guilty of substantial wrongdoing, if the gist of the publication is worse, you still have a cause of action. And we put the key quotes from Neely in our tab 6 SEC part. So, I mean, falsity, again, Dale Kitchens, Hollis Greenlaw, Mr. Moyetti are all in there. Malice, I do want to address motive in the case law because when I read their briefs and our briefs, and it was like cases passing in the night and they say it's not important, we say it is. So I looked at all those cases and I figured out why our cases are the right ones. It's because every single case that in Texas that Haman cites to say motive doesn't matter if the newspaper's trying to sell more ads. It doesn't matter if you don't call the plaintiff. Every one of those cases involved a media defendant, okay? And in those circumstances where a reporter is just doing their job without any motive to harm the subject, that doesn't show malice if they happen to forget to call the plaintiff or something like that. Our cases each involved non-media defendants who had motives to harm. Texas Waste Management, a business competitor who wanted to win a contract. Moldovan, the defendants wanted to ruin the business. Well, I mean, this is Moldovan on steroids here. This is way, way, way worse. Campbell, political opponents, and Bentley, who had a personal vendetta. Each of these cases involved non-media defendants who published in order to harm the plaintiff. And the motive was therefore strong evidence of malice. Those are the relevant cases. And this court, again in the Tatum versus Dallas Morning News,
I remember that one.
Found, even in a media case, they found evidence of malice because the reporter didn't call the Tatums to ask, why did you report your son's cause of death as a car crash and not suicide? And this court said that's evidence of actual malice because the reason he didn't call is because he already had a planned, I believe he said, thrust of the article. And if the Tatum said something differently, that would have ruined the article. So even when a non-media defendant has had a preconceived storyline or a motive, this court has found that. But look at Haman's cases. Every Texas case is a media defendant, and that's why there's a difference in the findings. And motive here, why was Haman drafting and publishing about UDF in the first place? It's a short and distort scheme. Short as much as you can, and then draft and publish stories that are specifically crafted to cause shareholder panic and drive down the target, so they call them target in their PR strategy, company's stock price significantly and quickly. Write and publish something so bad, the shareholders will go out and sell. And because, that's why motive is important here, why it matters here, because when you're researching, which just consisted of Haman's employees sifting through financials and not calling anyone up, and you know, you don't see any dialogue in the emails like, hey, what do you think about this? Should we check with someone? No. The dialogue internally is, hey, let's add some adjectives and adverbs here to make this sound worse. Let's have Haman's fiance, who hasn't even researched, add the word dire in front of some of this stuff. That's the research they were doing. And because that's what they were doing here, Haman had his preconceived storyline and avoided, rejected, ignored, falsified, or misrepresented anything that was inconsistent with its storyline. And Haman published under a fake name and instructed the website to lie to reporters about its identity, all for the written stated reason so the reader could not judge Haman's post with Haman's bias in mind. Now, I only have 45 seconds. I just want to point out, unless there's any other questions, in tab four of our handout.
The clock is a rough guideline in this instance. So.
Okay. Well, I'd like you to look at tab four because just, you know, since there's a lot of evidence here, I put together an example of just how hard Haman had to work with our financials, manipulate them to try to show we were a fraudulent company. And so he's got this, of course, fraudulent companies don't have $440 million in cash in 3 years from legitimate business operations, which is what the financials showed. So Haman, he says in his post, you know, loans appear larger, accrue larger and larger for years without ever generating any cash. And if you look at slide two, he puts together a loan table. Let me show you. And he tells the investors, too, don't go look yourself because it's way too complicated for you guys to figure out. And he says, these loans are significantly more demonstrate irregularities, representative of loans to the developer. And I looked up representative of the dictionary. It means like the rest. But when you look at the actual financials, they show $625 million capital, cash receipts of $318 million in 3 years before the post, 69% of the loans generating cash, Centurion, $158 million, majority generating cash. And there's even another financial part of the financial statement that shows another $130 million because of loans paid off. But you're
Whitley Penn never issued a going concern.
I'm sorry?
Whitley Penn never issued a going concern.
No, absolutely not. I don't even know what that is, but I know they didn't issue it because I know they stood by their financials and said they had no issues with the company. And Dale Kitchens tells you, you can't just walk away from a company if there's a problem. You still have a duty to disclose. Okay. Are there
any further questions?
Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate being able, allowing California lawyers to appear in front of you.
In Texas, we welcome everybody. California, New York. God bless you all. Glad you're here.
Landis Best, Your Honors, on behalf of appellants Haman and Bass. I'm glad to hear that you welcome people from New York as well.
Absolutely. We love
Although
everybody.
I have Texas roots. I do have family from Texas. Your Honors, I'd like to actually start with tab four that counsel referred to. I think it just shows again. We asked the question, just you have to look at the pleadings. Take that as a complaint. You can look at the pleadings as evidence and look at what it references. It references our posts. Read our posts. And you'll see that they're taking our posts out of context. They're cherry picking. They say here, they rely upon this a lot. They're saying that we said that UDF's loans didn't ever generate any cash receipts. It's not what we said. Just look and see. It's very clear. We didn't say that. We said that there were a substantial number of loans that weren't issuing cash receipts. And in fact, if you go to slide three, part three of her exhibit, it proves the point. It proves the point. It shows that they can't show falsity. They have not shown a prima facie case of falsity. If you look at their slide three. Okay, this is behind tab four. And you go to part three. Okay. Now, this is a chart that has all loans, all borrowers. And it says loans generating cash, 69%. Well, Your Honor, if I do the reverse math, I think I can do math like that. That means 31% were not generating cash. That was Haman's point. There wasn't sufficient cash being generated to fund distribution. So what did they do? They took investments from newer investors, used straw borrowers to then route payments to earlier investors. That's our point. It's the same point that the SEC made in its allegations. The Centurion-related notes are even more startling, 44%. If you look at this, it's saying that 44% were not generating cash. We're saying that's a material number. That's what we're saying in our posts. So again, we do urge you to look at our posts, read things in context. Look, we admit our gist is a hard-hitting gist. We don't dispute that. But we think that the gist that they present, this worthless Ponzi scheme gist, is not supported. But even if it is supported, I think Your Honors have focused on an important and key issue, which is actual malice. Have they shown, it's their burden, this is a gatekeeper motion, Your Honor. It's to weed out frivolous cases.
How do you address their argument that you've changed gists from the trial court to now?
I think you can look, and we haven't changed the gist from the trial court. You can look and see that our gist that we said to the trial court was we were asking questions. The general gist was we were asking questions about important questions, questions that should be encouraged, Your Honor, critical questions about a company, a public company, that's inviting scrutiny from investors, reliance on their financial statements. So there hasn't been a change in position. We've always presented our general gist as there were some bad things going on here. They were trying to hide the ball. But even if you accept their gist, there's no evidence that they've shown. They haven't shown a prima facie case of actual malice. They go to actual malice, and they say, oh, well, Haman's not a media defendant, so the case law doesn't apply to them. The First Amendment doesn't apply to them because they're not a media defendant? That's not true, Your Honor.
Who's got the burden on substantial truth?
They have burden on this motion of showing falsity.
The gist is not substantially correct.
That's right. Okay, they also have the burden of showing a prima facie case of actual malice. And this they can't do. I think if you look at all those cases, you will see that the various things that they've pointed to don't amount to actual malice. You can take a bunch of zeros, and if you add them together, it's still zero. They're really focusing on profit motive. It's not actual malice. Look at the Belo case. It's not actual malice. They're basing it on what they say is spite and ill will, and they're pointing to, you know, they say that there was limited discovery. There was a lot of discovery. There was generous pre-motion discovery here. We turned over 5,000 pages. Every email between Kyle Bass and Parker Lewis, who did most of the research here, every email that they exchanged that mentioned UDF, they have. Their case isn't going to get any better, Your Honor. They had all these documents, and they have cherry-picked. Their case is not going to get better. I want to say that UDF here is trying to use Haman as a scapegoat. But UDF is the company that has misled investors, and they're trying to mislead you. There are all those negative events that I talked about that would have happened, that did happen, notwithstanding what Haman said. The Whitley Penn resignation, the board member resignations, the broker's license revoked, the SEC investigating them since 2014. This is before Haman said a word.
We need to wrap it up in a little bit.
Okay. Your Honors, I just want to say that they're trying to show, we did respond to the Neely case in substance. They're trying to say that there's no different gist between the SEC complaint and Haman's allegations. The gist is basically the same. The sting to UDF is the same. They're trying to nitpick and say that it's different. To the extent that there's any difference whatsoever, this is the breathing space that the First Amendment requires. This is why we have a First Amendment, to create this breathing space, not to nitpick over slight differences in words. It's clear, I'd like to just say one more thing if I can, Your Honor. It's clear that their case boils down to emotion. They're claiming that my client was engaged in a short and distort scheme. Just remind yourself, our client went to the SEC with evidence. The SEC charged UDF. They didn't charge us. This is not a short and distort. This was a short and report, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you all for being here. Just a note, hang on a second. Because we've got friends from California and New York,
yeah.
I want to let you know that Texas comes from the Indian tribe Tejas. Name means friendly. So we are the friendly state, and we're glad you're here. Appreciate everybody's fine briefing, fine argument. This case is submitted, and this court is in recess.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.